Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. For a world without violence, that's the theme of an interfaith meeting currently taking place in Naples. Philippa Hitchin keeps us posted. And shining the spotlight on the liquefaction of the blood of San Gennaro, a Neapolitan Jesuit explains. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. As you probably know, Pope Benedict went to Naples on Sunday 21st of October, where after presiding over an open-air mass in the grand Piazza del Plebiscito there, he went uphill to the Capo di Monte Diocesan Seminary, with its stunning view over the Bay of Naples and a snow-capped Vesuvius for the occasion, to meet with many among the over 300 participants currently taking part in an interfaith peace meeting sponsored by the Catholic lay movement of Sant'Egidio. And ever since then, these same participants have got down to business, discussing practical problems facing religious leaders, who, as my colleague Philippa Hitchin tells me, search to seek peaceful coexistence between peoples.
On Monday, in a series of roundtable debates, not just here in Naples, but also in many of the surrounding towns, they spoke on a wide variety of themes, ranging from the role of religions in the Middle East, the role of scriptures in the monotheistic faiths, the future of religion in Europe, faith and reason, faith and science, or women working against violence. Among the Vatican officials taking part in these discussions was the head of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, French Cardinal Jean-Louis Thoron, who was chairing a panel on the role of religions together in dialogue. He talked about the Catholic Church's understanding of this interfaith adventure. It's much more than just a conversation, he said. It's also more than just negotiations to achieve some goal or other. It's really more of a pilgrimage, a lengthy process of getting to know and understand each other's point of view. Dialogue of this kind, he said, does bring with it risks and challenges, as we have to ask deep questions about how we live our own faith, as well as how the other person lives his or hers. Paradoxically, though, he said, we are condemned to dialogue because it's the only alternative to confrontation and conflict. So the meeting here in Naples is essential in its work of developing this dialogue for peace. Attending the forum here are several of the Muslim scholars who recently wrote a letter to the Pope and other Christian leaders calling for closer cooperation. So I asked Cardinal Thoron what kind of response the Church would like to make.
Very recently, 138 Muslim scholars wrote a letter, a common word, calling for closer cooperation. What kind of response can we expect to that letter?
Well, I cannot tell you exactly what kind of response will be given, but because we are actually studying how to answer exactly during this meeting in Naples, I've been in contact with other religious leaders to hear their opinion. But what it is sure that there will be a response, because this message contains very important elements. For example, one of the elements which is very important is that when the document speaks about Jesus, he's presented with quotation from the Gospel, from the New Testament, and this is very new, not from the Quran, but from our New Testament. So it's a kind of manifestation of respect towards the Christians. And there is also the awareness of the potential of peace, which is contained in religions, when they say that Muslims and Christians represent 50% of the world population. So it means that 50% of the world population is capable to contribute to the promotion of peace. So I think this is very important elements that we have to be answer to.
The letter was written, of course, by the more moderate elements within the Muslim world. How, in your view, can this message of peace and cooperation be extended to those with more extremist views within the different faiths?
Well, you know, when you are dialoguing with Muslims, the problem is exactly to see who is in front of you and what is the background. So I am not in a position to answer very precisely to your question. What perhaps will help that they will realize that they're not conquered by partners. And so I hope that a meeting like the one we have in Naples can help to understand that we cannot be happy the one without the others, and certainly not the one against the other.
The discussions among these religious leaders continue on Tuesday morning. Then in the afternoon, the members of the various churches and communities gather in different places for a moment of prayer before coming together for a procession and the signing of a final appeal for peace. In Naples at the St. Egidio Interfaith Forum, I'm Philippa Hitchin.
Many thanks there to my colleague Philippa Hitchin and to her guest, the head of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, Cardinal Jean-Louis Torrent. Another of the participants at this interfaith meeting Philippa spoke to was the Secretary General of the World Council of Churches, Reverend Dr. Samuel Kabir. Let's listen.
The mission of your organisation, of the WCC, is to promote unity amongst Christians. And yet many people here are talking about a cooling off of the ecumenical movement. Do you agree with that assessment, first of all?
No, I don't agree with that assessment. I know that there are those who would have wanted to see a highly visible way of talking about the achievements that the ecumenical movement is making towards the search for visible unity. But the fact that there isn't such a high-profiled program doesn't mean that really the ecumenical movement is cooling off. There are two examples that I can give to show that the ecumenical movement is in fact very much alive and even gathering momentum. One of the challenges that we have faced in the ecumenical movement is that of bringing on board more Christians who are convinced about the need for visible unity of Christians. It has taken very many years, but I would say that today, with the Global Christian Forum, which is a forum, yes, indeed, it's quite a loose forum. It's not a forum where we call each other to account for the visible that we seek. But nevertheless, for the first time in all these years, we have a good number of evangelicals belonging to the International Alliance of Evangelicals, and also some Pentecostals who themselves say 30 years ago would never have stepped anywhere near the work of the ecumenical movement. Today they have agreed to participate in the Global Christian Forum. And I think it's a good sign. It will take a while, of course, before they could sign up to the work, for example, of the joint working group between the WCC and the Vatican, because yes, they are not prepared to go that far, like we have done between the membership of WCC and the Vatican. But the fact that they have themselves now decided to join the forum that discusses about the challenges of Christians in the 21st century when it comes to responding to the Jesus prayer where our Lord calls for all to be one so that the world may believe. So that in itself to me is an encouragement. Secondly, I have just mentioned the Joint Christian Forum. Last year, we celebrated the 40 years since the formation of the joint working group, rather the joint working group between the WCC and the Catholic Church. And I would say that yes, we still have a long way to go, but the evaluation that we have done shows that there are many ways in which we can say we are clearly moving towards the goal of visible unity, because we have agreed on the many issues that need to be addressed in order to overcome the divisions that the churches have experienced over the years. So I think one could say that the ecumenical movement has made a lot of progress. Let me add a final word here, and this has to do with the enthusiasm that I have seen among the young people for ecumenism. 10, 15 years ago, we were very worried that the younger generation is not as committed to the search for unity, like the generation that clearly spearheaded the modern ecumenical movement. But I have talked with many young people here in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, and I am encouraged because many of them, in fact, seem to be even more ready to cooperate together, because they are not as taken to narrow interests of the confessional bodies to which they belong. I think many of them, and thanks again to the ecumenical movement, have been able to interact with each other so well, and I think they are prepared to work together. So that shows that while the challenges still remain, I think the ecumenical movement is quite alive.
You were talking about the dialogue between the World Council of Churches and the Catholic Church in particular. Many of your members criticised the recent motu proprio from the Vatican on the self-understanding of the Catholic Church. It doesn't substantially change the position or the view of the Catholic Church since the Second Vatican Council, and yet it's being seen as quite an obstacle. Do you agree with that or not?
I think the immediate reaction to the document suggests that many people did not quite understand neither the objective nor the full content of the document, because a closer look at the document shows that there hasn't been any substantial diversion from the position taken by the Second Vatican Council. I think what it tries to do is to clarify for the Catholic members on the whole question of the self-understanding of the Church and the self-understanding of the Catholic Church, and therefore I could say yes, there isn't much change in terms of position. What I think happened, which perhaps could have been avoided, is to issue such a statement as a new statement, because that's how many people took it to be. And therefore, they started asking, well, we have, for example, I mentioned the joint working group again. We have been working together for 40 years, and we thought that we had reached a joint understanding of the Church. So what is this all about? I think while I'm not calling for the Catholic Church to prepare the other churches for any encyclical or a statement from the Vatican. Nevertheless, I think if there is a kind of forewarning that this is coming and this is what it means, then it is possible to avoid the misunderstanding that has clearly been there on the part of many who read this news as they saw it as news. What I think we need to do is for us in the World Council, being the second party to the joint working group, to really talk with the Catholic leadership and agree on how we should interpret this to especially our constituency who might have been confused by what happened. But I think once they understand, it will be clear that the position has not changed.
Our thanks there to the Secretary General of the World Council of Churches, Reverend Dr. Samuel Kabir, who was speaking there to Philippa Hitchin. Meanwhile, let's move on in the broadcast and continue to speak about a different aspect of Naples, a far more popular one. Stay tuned. If you happen to be in Naples and want to know what's going on in the world, all you have to do is stroll down to San Gregorio Armeno and find out what figurines the artisans are working on to place in the cribs this Christmas season. And when something's happening in the city itself, this applies to an even greater extent. So when Pope Benedict visited Naples on Sunday, if he'd happened to wander down there, he would have recognized a white-clad figurine on show, representing him in his papal garb. But as we know, popes don't amble down narrow streets. What they do, and what Pope Benedict did, however, was pay a visit to the venue of the most popular devotion in town, this city's cathedral, which isn't very far away from there. Dedicated to San Gennaro, it's where the blood of this martyr is carefully guarded under lock and key in two glass vials. Blood which, famously, liquefies three times a year. And on Sunday, Pope Benedict went there to pray and to venerate the relics of this saint, to the great joy of the Neapolitan people. This cathedral has been described over the centuries by all travellers, from Charles Dickens to, more recently, H.V. Morton. I've asked Sean Patrick Lovett to read you a passage from H.V. Morton's A Traveller in Southern Italy. Let's listen.
The church is built upon the site of a temple of Apollo, and those Neapolitans fortunate enough to be christened there receive baptism at a huge basalt urn decorated with bacchanalian symbols, which is said to have come from a temple of Dionysus. In this perhaps appropriate pagan setting, the head and blood of St. Januarius are kept in an ornate chapel glittering with gold, silver, and precious marbles. A red brocade curtain conceals the silver doors of a safe behind the altar, which can be unlocked only by several keys, which are in the keeping of different officials. Inside is the Palladium of Naples, the phial containing a hard brown substance said to be the blood of St. Januarius, who was martyred in the year AD 305. Three times a year, upon the first Sunday in May, upon September 19th and December 16th, in the course of a noisy ceremony, the saint's blood generally liquefies, and sometimes turns red and appears, as many have said who have seen it, to boil. The reliquary is circular, and in size and shape is like a hand mirror. Clear glass back and front protects, and also reveals two ancient phials inside, which contain the sacred blood. I wondered how many of us, if we came across this reliquary in the window of a curiosity shop, would give it a second glance. The substance has never been chemically examined, therefore no one really knows whether it is truly blood or something else.
thanks go to Sean Patrick Lovett for reading that passage from H.V. Morton's A Traveller in Southern Italy for us. I'd like to share with you an interview focusing precisely on this phenomenon of liquefaction. I do that with Jesuit Father Pietro Michele Garofalo, who's Neapolitan born, of course. Father, Neapolitans have a particular devotion to Saint Januarius, or San Gennaro, as you call him in Naples. He's their patron saint. They pray to him for protection from earthquake, eruptions of Vesuvius, and for all kinds of personal reasons. It's a devotion linked to the blood of San Gennaro, preserved in two glass vials in the city's cathedral. Can you explain?
Oh, yes. The so-called the sign, this spiritual sign or miracle, it depends on how people might say. Cardinal Ursi, years ago, when he was the Cardinal of Naples, he might call it a sign. There are two files, that's right, two files, but really, generally, they say one, because one, really, in one, there is a lot of blood or a solid material. After, say, 2 minutes, half an hour, 2 hours, it melts. And the way in which it melts is never is exactly the same, because generally, you see, on September the 19th, when really it started, because it's the day St. Januarius was beheaded, the other small file is really very small, of different qualities, that there are some, you know, say, some drops, but really in one file it takes place, and there have been endless investigation about it.
Well, as you've just heard, Father Garofalo tells me there has been extensive scientific research surrounding this phenomenon down the centuries. No analysis of the blood inside the fowls has ever been carried out. That's forbidden for fear the fowls might break. Taking place several times a year on the days linked in a particular way to San Gennaro and carefully documented in a diary since 1659, hidden away inside the cathedral, this phenomenon is a complex one, he insists. But it does have a pattern to it.
It runs for 8 days.
You mean the blood stays liquid for eight days?
That's right. It becomes liquid in different ways, because sometimes it looks, it's boiling, it's very red. I have seen it.
But it doesn't always happen, does it?
No, it's connected with the famine, with plague, with the eruption of the Vesuvius. When the eruption of Vesuvius took place, I mean, the miracle didn't happen.
Which would explain why a people who live at the foot of a volcano like Vesuvius are keen to make sure the blood of San Gennaro does liquefy. Although Father Garofalo does add that beyond this phenomenon, Neapolitans are anyway people with strong faith. But I wondered, where does this event actually take place?
Generally, extraordinary fact, it takes place in the chapel. And there, behind the altar, where the blood is kept, the bishop, the cardinal, takes into, and people begin pray.
The miracle takes place in the presence of the hierarchy and occurs whatever the weather. The only thing that changes is the time it takes for the liquefaction to occur.
It's unexplainable, in other words. So that's why they call it a miracle, because it goes beyond knowledge. There are cases in which the blood, I mean, when it stops, when it may stop even obliquely, and it may last, say, half an hour, 2 hours, with this different kind of weather. It doesn't depend from the weather, it doesn't depend on anything. I mean, everything what had been, it goes beyond our reasoning.
Out of curiosity, I asked if the files were shown to the faithful and if candles were used to light this process. Once again, the fear of breaking the files surfaced. Candles are forbidden, I was told.
They use an electric torch in order to show in a better way for the people, because the cardinal goes around in order to show that people can kiss and see moving, and they can see quite clearly that their blood is really moving, and it is really blood. I mean, the strange thing for who wants to rationalize too much is the fact that, well, why on earth this takes place all the time? It becomes like a spectacle. I mean, it becomes like a show. Well, some people might say that God gives us, to the Neapolitans, the possibility that it doesn't give to others in a way.
So this is a miracle rather than just a popular devotion. Can you
it's a miracle. It's a miracle and public devotion as well, of course. It's public devotion. But the public devotion is focused, is helped by the miracle.
Can you place the devotion into its historical context? Who was Januarius San Gennaro?
San Gennaro, he was the bishop of Benevento, but he was born in Naples. Why was he killed, was beheaded in Pozzuoli, near Pozzuoli? Because he went there to visit some of his friends who were taken into prison. And once he discovered, he too was taken into prison, and then a little process and condemned.
So he was a persecuted Christian and became a martyr?
Yes, I mean, it was the hardest persecution at the time. I mean, it was the persecution of the Diocletian between 303, 305. We don't know exactly if this happened in 303 or 304. I mean, this was the period in which really the persecution hardened all over the places. People should come and see. You see, this is really very important, because otherwise, I mean, words do not give the right impression. One has to see and, of course, then organize, read about it in order to understand, I mean, this extraordinary event, because it's an extraordinary event.
My thanks there go to Jesuit Father Pietro Michele Garofalo for enlightening us on this popular devotion of the liquefaction of the blood of San Gennaro. And that brings us up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. And now some useful information indeed. If you happen to tune in on our 105 frequency, be sure to change the position of your radio's dial, as from the 1st of October, you'll be changing that to 93.3 FM. That's from the 1st of October.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.